Okay, another advantage of barter is cash conversion. Any barter items, merchandise, or services you acquire in addition to paying bills with can be sold or converted to cash at a fee well above the cost of acquiring them. I told you about Chrysler Corporation. Chrysler Corporation traded a Spatula. I told you that about the cars. I did something one time which is pretty interesting. I worked for a travel magazine, Holiday Magazine. Holiday Magazine was not the most successful magazine in the marketplace, and they had a lot of trouble selling advertising. Whenever they sold advertising, it was a quarterly magazine. They would sell pages at steep discounts because they had to do that to get advertisers to buy them. When they sold an advertisement at a steep discount, since it was a quarterly publication, the ad wouldn't run for 2 or 3 months. The advertiser wouldn't pay until a month or two after the ad ran because they would sell it through a representative. They'd have to pay 20% to the rep because the rep would normally sell it to an agency. They would have to pay 15%, so 35% of the already discounted price would be absorbed. They would end up getting only 65% of an already discounted purchase months after the ad ran.
Okay.
I came up with an idea of setting up profit centers to barter. We would barter with people for products or services that we knew before we accepted we had a cash buyer for. The products that we would trade at full rate, which is not discounted. So let's say a rate card is $8,000. Maybe we're selling the ad page for $3,000 in the past, and by the time everything the dust settled, we get $1,800 cash 3 months later. We would now trade the page for full rate, $8,000. We would get goods or services that we would not accept unless we already knew we could sell them to somebody instantly for at least 50 and hopefully 70 cents on the dollar of its value.
Okay.
We would do that before the ad ever came out, because when they made the transaction, we made them give us the credits right away, but we didn't have to fulfill the ad for months. We got cash up front. The ad would cost us approximately, let's say the $8,000 ad cost us $1,000. Let's say we would sell the $8,000 worth of barter that we traded for $6,000. So we'd make six times our money, have our money months ahead, get full retail instead of a pathetic discount, and get all kinds of people who wouldn't advertise exciting to do it.
Wow.
And give people who wanted the travel credits a heck of a deal to boot. Worked out pretty neat, doesn't it?
That's terrific.
Does this help stimulate your mind?
Yes.
You create a barter profit center. That's what I just talked about. It's pretty exciting, really, what you can do with it.
Can you tell us how you approached people, and if we haven't done this before, and maybe generate a letter with the prospect?
There's a lot of different ways to do it. You can do it straightforward. You can do it based on self-serving interest. You can write and say, my name is Jay Abraham. I own the Abraham Furniture Company. You may or may not know about us. We sell some of the most beautiful and expensive furniture in the city. I have an interesting proposition, I think, that would serve both of us very well. You are in the blank business. You sell something that I very much like, need, or would be interested in acquiring. Either you, your company, or one of your employees probably have a need for furniture. I would like to start a relationship with you. I have a relatively painless and easy entry idea of how we can both become each other's customer. I would like to barter or trade you $10,000 worth of my furniture for $10,000 worth of your product or service. I'm very willing to trade you retail to retail. I will use your services immediately. You may use my furniture immediately, or if you prefer, you can have up to a year to exercise it. How can you best make advantage of this? You can use it internally. You can suggest to somebody the application. You can use it in your offices. You can use it in your home. You can use it as gifts or sales inducements to motivate your staff or your salespeople to achieve more. You can use it to trade other people for some other goods or services your company wants or you want or need. You can use it as a profit center and sell it to your employees at a discount. Any of those uses, if you put them to productive advantage, you've gotten furniture that someday or sooner or later you would buy anyhow at a discount equal to whatever the goods or services I buying from you really cost you to produce. If we use goods or services that may be sitting in your inventory that have not sold for a while, it's a great way to convert to convert dormant assets into dynamic utilization. I am very willing, by the way, to take higher grade, lower popular items as long as we adjust accordingly. The best part about this transaction, however, is the next stage. If it works for me, I am very willing, if you don't want to continue on a barter basis, to make subsequent purchase on a pure cash basis. So it's a low entry, low risk way we can both develop a wonderful, wonderful buying relationship with each other. You're welcome to buy my furniture for cash in the future. If we both enjoy this basis, we can keep trading. You can be a profit center. We can do whatever you want. At least I think we should explore it because I think both of us can gain. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I have a feeling maybe you have done this in person more often than over the mail. Is that true?
I think it's a better proposition to do by telephone. In person is okay. Telephone is more expedient than in person. But normally if you walk somebody through the advantages, what they can do with yours, how it benefits them, the fact that you'll take things that maybe are distressed to them, you'll let them have anything they want, they can take it all now or later, you show them all the different ways they can use it internally, externally, self-servingly as a profit center, you show them how they can't lose on the deal, you show them how if it works, it'll evolve to cash transactions, you show them how if it works comfortably, they can set up their own profit center, you offer to help them with it. It's not a very difficult transaction to make.
Okay. And someone who is just new to business or thinking about starting out,
I've suggested a lot of people wanting to go in business become barter representatives and go to people who have goods or services that sells for a much higher price than it costs to create, or that they can create them at will and offer to represent them to all kinds of other businesses and transact barter for them and get as their fee either a share of the credits that they can use any way they want or a cash commission. And, I mean, a lot of companies have full-time, they have barter, I started to say, they have barter profit centers. They have full-time staff that do nothing more than trade. Sheraton, for example, has a barter division that trades what they call Sheraton Gold, which is gold certificates. You can use it any Sheraton in the world for room and food. I think it's room and food. It may just be room. In fact, it may just be a Sheraton room, but a lot of hotels do room and food. And they trade something like $5 million a year of this, and it reduces their capital expenditures, their advertising expenditures, their travel expenditures by $5 million.
So there's probably a whole lot of profit centers and medium-sized businesses that might be open to someone thinking about this.
The Home Shopping Network actually started as a barter permutation. The man who started it, I think his name was Paxton, owned a struggling radio station in, I think, Tampa, Florida, and he couldn't sell advertising, so he would trade people for all kinds of silly, like, retailers for toasters, and he had something like 1,000 toasters and can openers one time that he couldn't sell to anybody, so he started doing on radio, he started with auctions, and then he just did it on discount selling at discount prices, and it worked so well, he took the pilot concept and expanded it and bought time on cable and turned it into the Home Shopping Network. Well, you can obviously vastly expand your available advertising budget without using cash. An international airline company in competition with Federal Express hired a barter firm that I know to pay for its upcoming television schedule using credit for their courier service. The barter company put up the cash, ran the television, took credits with the air courier. In other words, it wasn't Federal Express, but it was one of their competitors. I can't tell you who it was, but they came to this friend of mine and said, we want to run advertising on TV, but we don't have a budget for it. He said, okay, I'll put up the $5 million in advertising, but I want $15 million worth of delivery services. They said yes. He took the $15 million and went to people who didn't use this competitive carrier and said, I'll sell you services with this carrier who's priced at comparable to Federal Express for 40% less than you're paying Federal Express and 40% off their rate. He sold $15 million approximately for nine, made a $4 million profit on the transaction. But the best thing about it for the carrier or for the package delivery company was when the barter credits were used up, the people who bought them at a discount were so used to using this carrier that they became cash paying customers.
That's beautiful.
Is this giving you some ideas?
Yes.
Pretty exciting, isn't it, Marty?
Yes, it is very exciting.
You can finance rapid growth without cash. One of the classic examples is billion-dollar cruise line, Carnival Cruise. a Florida-based company that's now the largest cruise line in the world. It started with one ship and insufficient operating capital. The line actually traded empty cabins for radio, television, and newspaper advertising in 100 cities over a 10-year period. The cost of an empty cabin once the ship sails is essentially zero. Plus, the passengers on the ship will spend considerable cash in the bar, in the casino, the gift shop, on shore excursions, booking their air travel through the cruise line. So the net cost to the cruise line to fill an empty cabin was literally less than zero. Stated differently, they made a massive profit off of the bartered cabin being occupied instead of going out empty. And here's the payoff for the cruise line. They used this technique to become the largest cruise line in the world and continuously advertised in 100 cities for more than 10 years without spending a penny in hard cash. A conservative estimate of how much sales they generated, Marty, $100 million. The owner of the cruise line is now a billionaire and is in the top 10 on the Forbes richest list, and it all started with one 30-year-old rusty ship and a heavy barter understanding of advertising.
There's a lesson there, Jay, somewhere.
This ought to be very exciting to people.
Yes.
Another advantage is you've got an ability to instantly and continuously create generate a steady stream of profits at far above closeout prices. An example, a cosmetic company traded a deodorant that was no longer being manufactured for advertising credits at full wholesale, thus getting their full market price in value for undesirable items. The advertising was used to advertise the new line. The old goods, which probably would have only brought in 10 cents on the dollar as a closeout item, brought full wholesale as an advertising trade. Thus, the chief financial officer did not have to write down the product. The company was saved not only the book loss, but the cash loss too. And they were able to take an item and benefit from it at full price while also saving millions of dollars in cash. In a different twist, a major Japanese auto manufacturer had 1,000 cars in the U.S. that they had been unable to sell at any price for 1 year. The cars were bartered through radio and TV stations, Marty, in selected markets at full retail value, in other words, window sticker. The advertising was used to introduce a new sports car that became a runaway success, which the company previously couldn't afford to run advertising for. The bottom line, the cars were sold at full retail and millions of dollars were saved on the advertising schedule, and the new sports car became the basis of a blockbuster success for the company because they advertised it constantly with the advertising they acquired solely on trade.
Okay. Let me interrupt you here. We have about 14 minutes left in the tape. Can you do me a four-minute scenario of something at a small scale that maybe people could apply?
Well, I mean, yeah, almost anybody can trade their own goods or services for things. A man wrote me after he learned bartering from me at a program that he went out and he traded whatever it was his company did for a full summer's worth of gardening, lawn care, and tree trimming.
Okay.
And that helped him. He said it was worth $3,000 in the summer.
Wow.
It cost him like $400 to do that. He would have paid $3,000 for it. It cost him $400. I have a friend who traded a Rolls-Royce automobile to a company for $500,000. He traded a Rolls-Royce automobile that at wholesale value was only really worth about $40,000 for $500,000 worth of TV time. He took the TV time, used half, and sold the other half for $25,000. He used the half he used, made him $500,000 because he used it for his company.
Hmm.
That's pretty interesting.
Yes, it is.
I have traded goods and services for clients all day long. When I used to be in the magazine business, we used to do seminars and conferences. We would trade booth space at the conferences to publishers for books and newsletter subscriptions. We would take the books and newsletter subscriptions and offer them in our magazine at full rate and sell $20,000-$30,000 worth a month. We would sell more than we ever could have sold. Like a booth may be worth $3,000. We would sell a $3,000 booth and barter for like $10,000 worth of books. We would sell all $10,000 of books in our magazine, so we actually got triple what the booth was worth, and we were having trouble selling the booth at $3,000.
And that ties in with continuing to work with your client, what other needs he might have.
Yeah, well, see, barter is a wonderful means. If any company who can create an ongoing supply of their product or service with big margins should seriously look to barter, for acquiring goods or services they need, for profit centers, for starting new customers, for increasing their buying power so they can even manufacture or create their product at a lesser. I mean, take a company. Let's say you have a service company. Let's say your service company has salaried technicians. Let's say you're not getting full utility out of those salaried technicians. Let's say you're paying them for 40 hours, but they're only working on average 30, really.
Okay.
They're sort of sitting around waiting.
Okay.
Let's say you're paying them 40 bucks. Let's say your real paying to them is 20 bucks an hour. For 10 hours a week, they're not being used. That's $200 a week you're paying them for. They're not being used.
Okay.
Let's say you got five of them, so it's $1,000. But let's say the market value of those $5,000 is really more like $5,000. If you traded that to somebody for something worth $5,000, it's like found money because you're paying them anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
And the person using them would start getting acclimated to it and would then had a high probability of becoming a cash client. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense. Okay, do you have time to continue?
Yeah, I got a couple more that are pretty interesting.
Okay.
Another advantage is turning excess inventory into cash without losing regular business. A major international hotel issues its own barter certificates in the amount of $7 million a year. This is another one. Over the years, the certificates have become extremely popular in the advertising community since they are used at more than 1,500 hotels around the world. The hotel corporation is able to trade for advertising with nearly any radio, TV, or outdoor advertising company because of the popularity. The hotel corporation saves $10 million, but what happens is they trade with different companies purposely every year so that this year you may get $1 million worth of my trade and I'll get $1 million worth of your billboards. Next year I'll do it with somebody else, but because your people are so comfortably used to staying at my hotels, next year you'll spend $1 million cash with me. Does that make sense?
Yes, makes sense.
The next one is recycled dollars right back to your own pockets. This is brilliant. The city of Palm Springs ordered advertising for its tourist bureau. It in order for the media, the radio station, the TV, the network, or magazine to be paid for the advertising they run, the Palm Springs Tourist Bureau requires that the media had to travel to Palm Springs and spend money in the city itself. In essence, the media had to spend an equal number of dollars in Palm Springs and show proof of purchase they were paid. In other words, I'm the Palm Springs Travel Bureau. I want to promote Palm Springs all over the country. If I spend $25,000 on your radio station or your television station on advertising, let's say you're in New York City,
okay,
I will only write you a check if you agree to spend that $25,000 I give you with merchants in my city buying goods or services that you would normally buy anyhow. Let's say you travel. You got to use my travel agency. Let's say you're going to buy a car. You got to buy it through a car dealer in Palm Springs, even if it's shipped to you there. Let's say you're going to buy a computer. You got to buy it from me. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
The last one that I would think of off the top of my head is stockholder benefits. Many companies issue employee and stockholder benefits or bonuses in barter, either for the company itself or for other barter they have acquired. They give Christmas presents, sales bonuses, customer inducements, all without using cash. I think that's pretty interesting, don't you?
A lot of intriguing ways to use barter. It's pretty incredible.
It's a profit center, leverage, profound competitive advantage. Everyone listening to this interview should instantly and perpetually commit themselves to take full advantage of.
And it seems to me the key to putting on your thinking cap to make this all work is to think in terms of someone else's interest.
How can I give them an advantage? And it's based on what people need, want, or could get impetuously excited about.
All right. Okay, we have about enough time for 10 ideas in 10 minutes.
Okay, well, let me come up with 10 good ones for you, Marty. The first one I want to talk about is it's a secret tax sheltering technique I have used for a lot of clients, and it's an ethical loophole you all have the ability to capitalize on. It's a wonderful technique for people making a lot of money, and when I reveal this to you, if you say, well, that's not me, you could teach it or share it or sell it to somebody else, and they could pay you a very big share of the savings realized from it. It's so simple and obvious, it's embarrassing when it's explained, but it works for almost everybody that uses it. That is this. The moment you understand the lifetime value, the marginal net worth, the critical components of what happens when a customer comes into your life and how many times they repurchase, once you determine what your maximum allowable cost is to acquire a customer, Then, if your business is sitting with a huge profit before year end, rather than paying the taxes on them, you can commit to an intelligent, customer-generating mailing or advertising campaign or dispatching of salespeople at year end that will write off most of your profit because you know predictably it'll produce customers where much more profit will come back to you in the subsequent year. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Is it confusing to you? Let me give you an example.
Okay.
1 year, a client of mine made $1 million profit. They learned that every time they brought in a new customer, that customer bought three times a year from them for life. They realized they could spend, I think it was $50 to acquire a customer, and they would still make something like $300 a year from that customer for years and years. They had a big profit. Instead of paying the taxes, they took about three-quarters of that profit and put it into mailing programs, sales letters they sent out all over the country right at year-end. They had to do it at year-end because they had to pay for it and do it before the year was over or they couldn't write it off.
Okay,
so by doing it right at the end of the year, they were able to roll the money and the revenue into the next year, and then the revenue came back. They got back all their write-off and a profit, but the biggest profit wasn't the return on that one-shot investment. It was the residual or ongoing or repeat business that came from all the new customers they produced, but they got the tax write-off to boot.
That is a fabulous idea. All right, number two, we're running out of time.
Work with ad agencies on a contingency basis, not a percentage one. Agencies normally have no advantage in really producing great results. They make 15% plus production. They have no inducement to produce. You're better off giving them a correlation to results, figuring out what is your acceptable or allowable result, or sales, or number of customers, or profit, showing them how you'll give them no money for placing the advertisement, but you'll give them more than 15% if the advertisement they create in place produces the result you want. That will all of a sudden induce them to be much more inclined to produce advertising that works and negotiating prices that are more advantageous to you. Most agencies have no inducement to do either because they make more if they pay more. They make more if you never know how it works.
Okay, I have time for two more ideas.
Stop spending so much money on advertising and develop and divert it into different ways. Advertising is normally the least viable, the least profitable, the least effective, the least efficient way you can reach customers, develop business. Explore all the other options first. The first option is your list is your best list. If you work your customers, you can normally grow more business and get more referrals than anything else. Endorsements are your second best list. People who work in kindred fields who have customers who are logical users of your products are the third best. Renting mailing lists are the fourth best. Targeted media is the fifth best. General advertising to the outside market is normally the worst possible utilization of your selling opportunity and your capital.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. One more idea, and we have to close for this month, Jay.
Well, I think the best idea I could give you after that is ask yourself, who already has my customer? Who's already doing business and has the trust and the respect of the prospective customer I want to reach? And who could I go to who would not be a direct competitor, who would be in a great position to either endorse me, do a joint venture with me, have their selling people or their distribution line offer my product or service to their customers also for a profit shift? If you look at that, you'll be able to take fullest advantage of all kinds of people who've already sunk years and hundreds of millions of dollars into building goodwill and identifying your customer, and you'll have to spend nothing on a fixed basis, only be spending money on a results basis to access them. That's pretty much it, Marty.
Jay Abraham with the Wizard's Edge, thanks so much for sharing with us this month. We'll look forward to what we can do next month, but in the meantime, there's a whole bunch of things I have to do.
Thank you, Marty.
All right, bye-bye. Marty Stacey, look forward to talking to you next month. Welcome once again to the Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, Communications Director for The Edge. Jay, before we do a blitz today, I want to ask you, when did you decide you were going to have control of your life? You talk about that a lot in these tapes.
I don't know if I can pinpoint an exact time, but I'll give you a couple of the key events that happened. First of all, anyone who's ever followed my career knows that I got started in my career at a very young age. I was 18, married, and I had two kids by the time I was 20, and no real negotiable business skill. And I started out on the wrong side of the ledger. I was an expense. I was a clerk. I was an internal, a clerical type of an office personnel. And I was very limited and restricted in the amount of money I could create and the amount of contribution I could make. And very quickly, I realized that the only way I could achieve the kind of growth, personal enrichment, financial security that I needed was going to be for me to evolve from the expense side to the sales contribution side of the ledger. And I had to quickly reorient my thinking to figure what activities, what actions, what events occurred in the business situation that produced commerce, that generated sales, that increased revenue, that added customers. And I started becoming fixated on studying and understanding and identifying all those. That was a key point. Then, after I started making people lots of money and working for them and getting bonuses, but seeing them get enriched beyond all comprehension and make all kinds of unlimited income, I realized that security is nothing more than the faith, the confidence, the trust you've got in yourself and your ability to perform. So I stopped worrying about making salaries and fees, and I started only wanting to get very, very much affixed to the variable income I created. I wanted to be vested. I wanted to basically share. I didn't want to be paid for working. I wanted to be paid only for the results in direct proportion to the level of the results my efforts produced. I then realized you had to get leverage on yourself and your actions, and I realized that I needed to be able to create vehicles, in the case of my actions, add sales programming, strategic concepts that I could, in essence, give intellectual property right value to, lease to people to use while I was not there. In other words, while I am talking to you right now, there are people in this country using programming I created, paying me lease fees every month in the form of variable compensation in direct proportion to the amount of sales or profits or new customers and all kinds of different bases that I get paid on that they generate. And I realized you need to get leverage to accomplish things. And I also realized that the same action has to create three different functions: current income, seed future income, and create net worth that you can sell to other people. And that became a reorientation of my work for others and for myself.
Wow, tremendous. Okay, on the edge, we generally share 10 ideas in 10 minutes at the end of the program, and we do a lot of different things, a lot of different strategies through the tape. Do you remember Proud Mary with Ike and Tina Turner? You remember how they start kind of slow and easy and then end up doing it real hard?
Sure.
Why don't we do a show like that today where you maybe just unload a lot of the ideas that you've been getting? Is that fair?
Sure. You know, I was thinking about, remember the old show Laugh-In?
Right.
Remember the guy that always said, sock it to me? Well, we can have sock be stream of consciousness today, SOC, and we'll just sort of, I'll be glad to do a free form with you. It might be fun.
All right, here. Best kept secrets. Off the top, what
well,
are
I have
those?
Two best kept secrets that I think are the essence of what I'm all about, and I think most people, when they understand these two elements, they help make make utilizing my methods, my philosophies, and my principles much more powerful. The first secret, I think, is that marketing is the ultimate business leverage you've got. It costs a company the same fixed effort, time, and expense to run an ad, to do a mailing piece, to dispatch a salesperson, to make a telephone call, to send out a catalog, irrespective of whether that action produces one lead or 10 leads, or one customer or 101 customers. It costs the same effort and expense to generate a sale, whether that sale is for $10 or for $110. It costs the same effort to generate a sale as it does an ongoing customer. By that I mean the same basic effort can produce one sale that never recurs, or it can produce one customer who keeps coming back once a month forever and ever and ever. When you have that kind of massive leverage, you've got to realize that marketing gives you the one remaining leverage your business has. There's not a lot of leverage left in business. The tax laws have changed to the point where there aren't a lot of write-offs. I guess you can institute a second shift, and to the extent that you're not getting full utility out of your staff or your equipment, you do have a little bit of leverage there. But by and large, you don't have a lot of buying power advantage over your competitor. You don't have a lot of labor advantage over your competitor. Maybe you have a little bit of technology advantage, but you've got massive. You can have marketing advantage to the tune of 20-1 per transaction, and then you've got the geometric progression. If you had 20 times better leverage on your ads, and you had 3 times better leverage on your selling skills, and you had 4 times better leverage on your reutilization, meaning the residual value you get from your customers and your activities, all of a sudden it's 20 times 3 times 4 or 600 times 4, 2,400% leverage you've just gotten over your competitor. And that's profound. Most people only have 2 or 3 or 5 or 10% advantage on manufacturing or personnel or delivery. You could have 24 or 50 times advantage with marketing. So marketing is really the ultimate business leverage you have available. Number two secret, which is a very profound one, is that tunnel vision may be hurting your business. Funnel vision can create awesome success. Most people, as I say, spend the entire scope of their professional lives, their business lives, in one or two fields. They become a dichotomy of sort, Marty. On one hand, they're extraordinarily expert at the management and the intricacies and the nuances of that industry, semicolon, however, comma. All they really know is how that industry operates, which is scarily similar to one another. If you look at 20 companies in an industry, all competitors of one another, plus or minus 20%, each one is doing about the same thing, about the same way. Some are much better at it, some are much worse. Some are more sophisticated, some aren't. But they're all basically utilizing, from a marketing context, the same basic marketing philosophy and the same basic marketing programming. When you learn that you've got tunnel vision, all you know is what your industry knows, which may not be anywhere close to the best way to do it, and that there may be 50 or 100 or 200 alternative methods of selling, of customer generation, of profit building, of marketing that you could be employing by borrowing the success secrets, methods, patterns, principles from all kinds of other non-related industries and incorporating them into your own, you've got an incorporated ability to give yourself even greater leverage. So the truth of the matter is, the first thing you got to do is realize, of all the advantages you've got, marketing is the ultimate business leverage. Number two, your very expertise in what you do is a form of myopia or tunnel vision. You've got to get to the point of having funnel vision and letting all the success principles and methods from outside your industry funnel into you, and you don't have to recreate the wheel. All you have to do is borrow from other industries the principles that have already been success proven but never discovered or known about in your industry, and you gain, again, the kind of catapulting or stratospheric advantage that is really meaningful. 2% advantage isn't what you want. You want quantum leap advantage over people, and the way to give it to yourself is to practice these two philosophies, believe in them, and then drive every action that you do based on those. That's the fuel that will drive them.
That leads me to this next question. I have heard that people with advanced business degrees come to your seminars and go away saying they learned more in your 3 or 5 day seminar than they did in all of their business school experience. How about sharing with us some things that maybe you didn't learn at Harvard Business School?
Sure. And understand this. I teach business from a hands-on, real-world, street-savvy, entrepreneurial perspective. I'm not theoretical. I'm not presupposing you've got a staff of 50 people and 14 different line people and all kinds of middle management to help. I'm not presuming you've got unlimited capital. I'm taking a position. Every action you take, every effort you expend, every day you invest, every dollar you commit has to justify its existence, has to be optimized. And I look at life very realistically from the mindset and the eye of somebody who's actually done it, not a theoretical person. I'm fortunate we've had hundreds of MBAs and PhDs from some very prestigious business schools, including Harvard, including Cornell, including Stanford, come to us. And from an entrepreneurial mindset about making money, generating sales, creating profits, making business happen, getting businesses growing, I think our perspective is decisively different than most of the ones extolled in theoretical-based business schools. There's 5 basic premises I start people with that they aren't going to teach you in any business school, but they're very integral to your being able to adopt, understand, and utilize this whole mindset. Number one, People are silently begging to be led. They are crying out, Marty, to know more about your product or service so they can make an educated buying decision. When customers have unanswered questions, they are less likely to buy your product or service. By educating your customers, you'll watch your profits soar. You've got to lead them to the reasons why they should do something. You've got to lead them to the reasons why you are doing something. You've got to lead them to the difference, the significance, the impact, the result something will have in their life. You've got to lead them to realize why they need to want it more than not and why they're going to be benefited. And finally, you've got to lead them to what they have to do to take action now. That's true of ads, of sales letters, of sales presentations, of everything that happens. That's a fundamental to my principles. That's number one. Number two, you've got to tell people what specific action to take. Few businesses realize, Marty, they must lead the customer to action, telling them exactly how to obtain your product or service, and it can't be abstract. Your offer has got to be clear. They've got to see why it's important now. They've got to see what exactly has to occur to take advantage of it, and you got to tell them what they're going to realize or experience once they've done that. In other words, you got to sell them on the advantage it's going to be in their life, the result, how different it's going to be when they have that product in their possession or that service working for them or protecting them or enhancing them.
Okay.
Number three, people won't appreciate, Marty, what you've done for them or will do for them unless and until you educate them about the value of that service. I'll give you a good example. Years ago, I did a training program. This training program was $15,000, and I put everything I had into it. But at the very last minute, I realized that I was light on explanatory understanding and detailed illustration of how to craft an ad. I had 2 hours, but I thought it needed more because it was such a critical function to the kind of people that were coming. And I had done a different training program for $5,000, and about 4 of the hours of that were one of the greatest copywriters in advertising and direct mail alive, and I had videotaped him. And I had 4 hours. But I had no place to put this 4 hours on the agenda. Everything was absolutely committed. So what I did was I took the 4 hours on videotape that had cost me probably $10,000 to videotape. I sent it out and had them edit it down to 90 great minutes. I made the 90 minutes a perfect, seamlessly edited 90 minutes. I had to find time to put it, so I had to take a lunch time when people were going to go to the restaurants on their own, and I had to feed them, which cost me about $3,000. I had to get pizzas and other things and feed the people in the room. There were hundreds of people. I didn't have any equipment to show them because there were so many people. I had to rent big screen TVs and a VCR, which cost me about $2,000, just so I could show it. And I had to sit there to moderate, so it screwed up a lot of plans that I had for that lunch hour because I had a bunch of meetings with people who'd flown in. That was the only hour and a half I had available in the whole show. Now, when I ran this video that I'd gone to enormous efforts and by the way, I also made copies for everyone to take home because I thought it was so important. That was another $10,000. So it's probably a $40,000 decision. A lot of money, Marty. But when I ran the video, when they edited it, one thing they didn't edit out was when the man doing the video originally did the session for me a couple years ago that I videotaped, he had brought with him a couple of really neat little reports that he distributed to the public that were there. And they were neat little reports. They weren't critical, but they were nice. And they mentioned in some of the copy the report I'm going to give you. Okay, so everyone comes to the session for $15,000. They get everything I was going to give them, and then they get this as a bonus. But I didn't tell them it was a bonus originally. And they watched it. I gave them the pizzas. I gave them that. They watched the thing. I issued everybody the videotape copies I made for them to have a permanent record at home. And the result was 90% of the people were mad because they didn't get the report. Fortunately, I stood up and I said, I don't think you get it. You weren't even supposed to see the show. I spent $10,000 originally on it. I spent another $10,000 or $15,000 editing it. I spent $4,000 on the pizza. I spent $4,000 on the renting of the equipment. I spent another $4,000 or $5,000 on the video just so you would have this one missing link to the puzzle. Well, when I explained to them what I had done for them, when I educated them to appreciate what had gone on, they went immediately from anger to incredible appreciation. But that was only possible because I turned the tables. People cannot be expected to appreciate what has gone into the doing of something, what has gone into the creating of something, what goes into the offering of something, unless you explain to them. If your ability to sell products at a lesser price than your competitor is a function of your buying in massive quantity, if you're having to have $2 million tied up in an inventory, if you're having to have a full 50,000 square foot storage facility, if you're having to have impeccable credit and do things that your competitors either can't do or wouldn't dare to do, and you don't tell your customers, they don't appreciate what's going on. Conversely, if you're very expensive, you've got to tell them why and what they get that they never realized they get, intangibly and otherwise, or they won't appreciate it. Don't disturb yourself by disacknowledging the process, the composition, the construction, the integral functions and activities and factors that contribute to the creation or the rendering or the producing of what you're doing, because people are not psychic. They can't perceive. They can't discern. They can't comprehend what went into the creation or the bending or the rendering of something until and unless you share it with them. So it's very important. Number four, bonuses can make a profound difference to your overall sales proposition by carefully acquiring, Marty, high perceived value but low cost to fulfill bonus products. Your company can tower over your competitors in real value provided to the customer. In other words, if everybody's all selling the same generic commodity-type product or service for a certain amount, if you can make deals with companies that render greater products or services that complement or don't, and add that to the quotient, you can not only make your company and your product proprietary because it's incomparable now because everyone else is selling just the commodity, you can make the offer extremely attractive. I'll use a very mundane example. Anyone ever seen the commercials for Sports Illustrated?
Okay.
You know that when you subscribe, you get three other things. You normally get you get the swimsuit issue as a bonus. You normally get a radio or a clock or something totally seemingly irrelevant, but something that has a lot of higher perceived value. But the trick is they buy a million of them, and it may be a $50 clock, but they get them probably for $3 in the quantity they make.
Okay.
So the trick is, what can you add to the transaction that either goes with the subject matter and as an extension and complementary, or has no relevancy but is so desirable on its own that, all things being equal, if you were contemplating, if you were not skeptical but deliberating whether to buy this product or not, or whether to buy this product or service from your company or from some other company, if I added to the transaction this bonus, it would make all the difference of weighting the scale in favor of deciding. Does that help?
Tremendous edge there.
Those are the answers, Marty.
Okay. Quickly, just on your comment regarding educating people, the reason we don't do that without J. Abraham telling us that, is that because we're still wanting to be served rather than helping other people, thinking
well,
in terms of their...
I think three things, Marty. Number one, we live our life in our business so much that we take so much for granted. It's almost implicit to us that everybody else understands it and they don't. Number two, we've never been really taught or directed to realize that through education comes clarity and desire. Think about everything you've ever bought in your life. Anything you've ever really wanted, you only wanted it after somebody or something educated you to see that it was desirable, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even fads. You didn't want a fad. You weren't the first in your block. Very rarely are you the first in the block to want something. You wait until other people discriminate and discern and see value. And value can be everything from uniqueness to ego to stature to utility. But until you're educated to see the value, you don't want something, do you?
Right. No, I don't.
It just goes the other way. Everything that you would respond to, everyone else will, because human nature is human nature is human nature, Marty.
Okay. Dangerous myths. Nine dangerous myths. What are those?
I try to summarize a lot of my big picture issues and principles into some simple little lessons that I think anybody can really easily understand. And there are nine dangerous business myths that I think many, many companies are practicing. And really what they are is the right and wrong ways to build your business from wherever it is to wherever you want to go. One of them is, most people, frankly, they utilize institutional advertising, and they think it's institutional is more effective than direct response advertising, and it's false. Almost every print ad, mailing piece, radio or television commercial around is based on institutional-type advertising, Marty. At best, institutional produces a deferred result. At worst, and this applies to about 100% of all advertising out there, institutional is ineffective, vacuous, wasteful. It's just a totally dissipated expense that accomplishes no productive purpose whatsoever except to tell how great the company is or how old and stable they are. And it just – all it is it's – it's aggrandizing you when your job has got to be really to aggrandize the customer. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but as you already know, this goes against just about everybody.
That's why the people who understand and practice are going to have such an enduring and such an incomprehensibly powerful edge and advantage, an almost unfair advantage over everybody they compete against, because most people are inherently unwilling to even recognize, understand, and even if they understand it, it's hard for them to act on it. But you got to realize, if you run institutional advertising that tells how great you are, no one cares. If you run advertising that's direct response and tells how great they're going to be, but only if they avail themselves, so they've got to act now and either buy or come in or call or send for or get a free this or try this out. But it's designed to go from institutional to direct response, to evoke a direct and immediate response from the qualified customer or prospect you're trying to reach. It'll change everything in the way your business operates.
Mm. The exciting thing about understanding myths is the profit potential on the other side.
Oh, yes. The flip side is so enriching, it's unbelievable.
All right. Myth number two, dangerous myth number two.
Most people think there's no reason to develop a unique selling proposition or articulate it as part of their marketing because everybody already knows what we do. That's patently wrong, Marty. No single statement could be further from the truth. Failure to develop a unique selling proposition or a USP for use in all your advertising, all your selling efforts, all your communication and positioning and personification of what you do to the outside marketplace is almost as common as failing to use direct response advertising. I haven't done a lot of work on USP in past issues. We're going to do a whole section on it, as you know, in one of the upcoming programs. But the unique selling proposition, Marty, is the distinguishing advantage you portray in all your marketing, advertising, and sales efforts. I think we did a simple example, but I'll give you three again, so it'll be really quickly. When I say, if you absolutely, positively have to have your package delivered by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, Federal Express, that's the USP. It's unquestionably, if it has to be there at a certain time without fail, there's one company to call on. That was their USP. The next one is, we're number two, so we have to try harder. That absolutely personifies the fact that here's a company that's not the biggest, so they got to work their butts off to be better, to be more loved, to make you happier, to serve you better. That makes sense. That's a USP. Hot, juicy, delicious pizza delivered to your door fresh in 30 minutes or it's yours free. Domino's. That's pretty powerful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, those are unique selling propositions. It's the distinguishing advantage you portray in all your marketing above and beyond your competitors. What holds you out to be special in the eyes of the customers, special being what you do better, more satisfying, more advantageously for your customer that they desire. That's your unique selling proposition. It's the philosophical foundation of your business, Marty, and its essence should pervade everything you do. Your USP may be that you only sell the highest grade products in the industry or that you sell your products at the lowest markup. Your USP may be that you have everything in the inventory at all times, no out of stock, waiting, or back orders, or that you maintain five times more service personnel than anyone else in your industry so you can respond in 3 hours instead of 3 days. Whatever it is, and you've got to do some soul searching. As I said, we're going to do a special segment of the Wizard's Edge just on USP and a couple of kindred issues to make certain people understand it, but the USP is integral and essential to gaining distinction and preeminence in your field. Without it, you are severely hamstrung. It's one of the biggest myths. The failure to have a USP and thinking that that's fine is like saying I'm going boating without a rudder, Marty.
Bit of a problem.
The third great dangerous myth is that people think all my marketing dollars should be spent bringing new customers in the door. There's not much money in selling old customers anything else, and that's patently untrue. We talked about the three ways to grow a business, I think, in one of the first issues, and we talked about it also, I think, on the Tony Robbins interview tape that we sent to a lot of these people. Most companies never address the back end or residual part of their business, but the back end is all important. You've got to realize this. It costs you or your company a small fortune to bring customers in the first time. If you run advertising, if you do direct mail, if you dispatch salespeople in the field, they may call on 10 companies or 10 customer prospects before they get one sale. I've seen statistics that boggle the mind. They say a sales call costs $140 just to make a call, not to sell anybody. I know people who do lead generating that measure, analyze, and quantify it tell me that it costs them as much as $100 or more in certain categories just to get a prospect – to send back a card or to come in or to pick up the phone and call. When it costs you that kind of money to scan or search through or sift through hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of suspects to find prospects, not even customers yet, you owe it to yourself to invest an enormous amount of effort once you get a customer to resell them, because the cost of reselling them on a cost of sales basis is a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the cost to get them in the first place. Repurchases are many times more profitable than new sales.
When you say these are dangerous myths, you really do mean dangerous.
So you got to realize, my take on life is most of you are deluded optimists. You do not realize the level of constraint, restriction, and limitation you have imposed on your own earnings, success, happiness, profitability, and cash flow by practicing these kinds of delusions or myths. I'm just trying to say they're very dangerous if you want a higher standard of life, if you want a higher quality of living, if you want more control over your business, if you want more money in your bank, if you want to retire richer, if you want to have a nicer car, if you want your family to be without debt, if you want your children in the best colleges, if you want the peace of mind and the blessed freedom to do what you want when you want to, because you know you got a business generating the maximum cash flow far more than you need. You got to eradicate these delusions in the way you operate your business.
Okay, dangerous myth number four. What's that?
Dangerous myth number four is all I have to do is list basic features. If the product or service fits the needs of the customers, they'll buy. Well, not on your life, Marty. 90% of the business has never precisely determined the needs, desires, results, or requirements of the people to whom they are trying to sell before they develop a product or service package or promotion. You got to basically understand, people don't buy features. They buy the benefits, the performance results those features produce or perform or provide. Most companies just say, yeah, we've got this in five colors. Well, I mean, that's not important. The question is, one of these colors will probably work best in your situation. Tell me about your situation. I'll make a recommendation. Or we've got these with all these different options. Well, the options do certain things. They let the product perform better, longer, easier, faster, more efficient, without maintenance. They do. What are the performance characteristics of the features? Most people stop just with features. People don't care about features. I saw a wonderful, wonderful true story about two different people selling very expensive big screen color TVs, and one person sold all the features and one person sold all the benefits. The person selling all the benefits literally outsold the feature-based salesperson by something like 10 times. Mm-hmm. And when they studied to try to see what the difference was, it was that one said, wow, look, this has got 28 function, it's got digital memory, it's got, you know, auto resonation, and the other guy said, let me tell you what this can do for you. You can watch 7 pictures at the same time. Anytime there's any fuzziness, you push this button and it corrects it automatically. Anytime you want you want stereo, you push this and it comes out of both sides and it sounds like results. Sounds like you're at a conference hall. If there's action, you can see it. It's got the dimension of movement because it comes in one side and goes out the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see the difference?
Yeah.
Very profound.
Okay, myth number five.
Myth number five, Marty, is people think the only way to get out of a bad business situation is to simply cut prices. Price cutting alone rarely does the job. Explaining the reason for cutting the prices almost always does the job.
Okay, I want to back up and ask about myth number four. Talk about designing a product with the ultimate user in mind rather than vice versa. That's a new idea for people, I think.
I think the problem with most people is they decide they're going to be in this business for them. And I think on past two or three past programs, we've pretty well pummeled the philosophy issue of you're in it for the other them, for the customer.
Right.
You don't do anything for you except serve the customer. We can't. If you design the product for you without the customer being a part of it, you've missed the first critical link in the chain. You've got to basically say what benefits the customers want. What benefits can give them even greater performance or satisfaction or quality or certainty in their lives other than they're getting right now? What benefits can the customer derive out of this product that they aren't getting anywhere else, or they can get easier? What benefits can we demonstrate to them that will result to them, not to us, by them availing themselves of this product, that will make it valuable to them? And until and unless you can answer all those questions, you shouldn't come out with a new product.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter what benefits you want. If you say, well, we can make this cheaper, or we can use our existing equipment, it doesn't matter. The market has no – I mean, it's not helping the market unless you say, well, we can offer a product they're normally spending $400 on for $300 because we can save $200 on manufacturing and still make ourselves $70 a unit wholesale and be happy as – you see? Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You got to keep your focus on what's in it for them, the customer. And until and unless you can answer that continuously and clearly, you're missing the boat.
Okay. Talk about this myth number five now about slashing prices.
Well, I'll give you a story that's a better example, okay?
Okay.
Years and years ago, I had a client that was in the very, very expensive investment-grade gem business when it was a very, very hot industry back in the 70s when hard assets were very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And we sold like $50 million, I think, of precious gems. However, when the market collapsed, which it did do back in 1979 or 80, we got stuck with something like, and it's I think about $10 million at wholesale that we bought.
Okay.
The market collapsed. The first thing they did was lower their price and send a price list out. Nobody bought, literally. They came to me, and I said, I'll be glad to do it, but I want 25%. And we negotiated for a while, and they finally gave it to me. So I came up with a very simple process. I told the truth in a reason-why basis. They were in trouble. They needed. They had a lot of money. They had $10 million in wholesale sitting in inventory that was just killing them. So I wrote a letter to all their customers, and I said the truth. We have a problem, and it could be a great opportunity for you. But I could tell you about it, tell you what our options are, tell you what we've decided to do, tell you why we decided to do it, tell you why we think it makes sense for you, and then give you the first chance to avail yourself of it if it makes intelligent and productive sense. So first of all, I told them that the market had changed, that we had gems that they were gorgeous investment-grade color gems, rubies, emeralds, sapphires. However, the market had changed so massively that they no longer were a hot commodity, and we bought the biggest and the highest size ones and the most beautiful, and they were even the least. Right now, lower, lesser-grade ones were selling, but the expensive stuff were dead. I told them what we paid for it when we bought it a year ago. That's before the market had dropped price-wise.
Okay.
I told them when we bought it what those stones would have been worth at retail, which was about twice that. And I told them today what the prices were still going to be at retail, and I told them what our choices were, that we could sit and have our money tied up until the market turned, which it might not do for years. We could sell it to some slime of a hatchet man wholesaler who would give us low gavel rate, you know, liquidation price for them, mm-hmm. and we would lose a lot of money on it, and he would never do anything else with us. We'd never see him again, and basically we'd get no goodwill out of it. Or we could pass the same liquidation based prices on to our customers, lose our butts on it, but get such goodwill that we do such a great service for them, and they would be in a position where they'd probably sometime in the future want to reciprocate when the market conditions are right by buying something else from us. I explained to them why it was to our advantage to do that. I said, frankly, the rare coin market, which is what we're in, is very, very hot. If we take our $10 million out of gems, which are not selling, and it's stuck, and basically our money is just sitting idly, if we only got $8 million of our $10 million, and we lost $2 million, but we put the $8 million into rare coins that are hot, that money will turn probably five times a year, and at nominal margins will make so much more money that it's a more prudent business decision. So we've made the decision to liquidate our inventory. We'd like to, first of all, liquidate it through you and let you get the same value that the wholesalers will pay because we think it's a better investment long-term in you. Then I told them, I described each gem dimensionally as a gemologist would, by grade, by cut, by dimension, by clarity, by weight, by fieriness, by key phrases that apply to different kinds of colored gems. I told them if they had the slightest interest, call any quality jeweler and describe it. When they described it, ask them if they would quote them a price to acquire a similar stone for them. I said, if the price you get quoted isn't at least double what we're asking, don't even put a purchase request in for the stone from us. Then I said, but if you do decide to purchase it from us, don't consider the purchase binding until after we have shipped the stone to you, and then you've retaken it to a jeweler, and they've appraised it for you. If it doesn't appraise at very nearly twice what you pay, feel free to send it back within 10 days, and we will not consider the purchase binding. Mm. That's a lot different than articulating and just cutting prices.
Oh, wow. Can you...
We sold all the stones, by the way, except for three.
What strategy could the people listening to the Wizard's Edge apply in their own business lives? Can you give us a couple of rules?
I'm giving this a multiple strategy, but the strategies that I think that are emanating from this discussion, Marty, are the following. Number one, don't advertise unless it's designed to evoke a response. Number two, incorporate a unique selling proposition that telegraphs the advantage, the result, the key demonstrable benefit that's in it for the customer. Number three, understand that the acquisition of customers is the most expensive investment your business will make. The reselling of customers is the least expensive. Put a lot of your effort strategically on reselling because the sales will be much more profitable. One sale could be five times as profitable or 10 times as profitable on a repeat as an initial one. So every subsequent repurchase you get enriches you by many times a new purchase. Number four is don't fixate on features. Fixate on benefits and results to the customer. Number five, always articulate and explain the reasons why for everything, even a sale.
Okay. All right. So I missed the basic premise there. You're explaining why you're having a sale, in essence.
Yeah, what the basis, why I'm having it, why I'm pricing it, why I've got the product, why I'm offering you the good advantage. And if you do that, it makes you have power. Does that make sense?
Yeah, a lot of sense. All right, dangerous myth number six.
The myth people say is the more convenient we make it for customers to do business with us, the less profit we'll make. That's a joke. The more convenient you make it, the easier you make it, the more desirable you make it, the more fun you make it, the more business you'll do. You can't make doing business easy enough, pleasant enough, desirable enough, pleasurable enough. You cannot educate people enough. You cannot inform them. You cannot guide them. You cannot direct them. You cannot make ordering too easy. You cannot make doing business with you too desirable or pleasurable. Think about it. What are the most joyous places to buy and deal with? Those are the places you probably go to most often, aren't they, Marty?
Yeah, common sense. Yeah. Okay, dangerous myth number seven.
Well, it's a little bit of a duplication, but it permeates everything. No matter what, never tell customers the reasons why. People think they should never let people in on the method to their madness. They keep everything close to the vest. They live on a needs-to-know type of a – they think they're espionage officers.
Okay.
I believe whenever you make an offer, ask for a sale, run an ad, have a salesperson make a proposition to a customer or prospect, offer a product or service for sale at any specific price – you should always tell the reason why. Why can you sell a product or service at a lower price than your competitor? If your price is high, is your product far superior, or the support you give people? The more embraceable, Marty, factual, believable, credible, and plausible reasons you give me, the customer, for dealing with your business, the more compelled I am to favor you with my business. Simple, isn't it?
Yeah. But the simple is what we usually don't use. Myth number eight.
Myth number eight, even if they're still working, most marketing campaigns should be discontinued because before they become boring. People will stop running ads or using selling campaigns or promotions or sales or special offers right after they do it because they get tired of seeing it. They don't understand the only time to stop doing something is when the market gets tired of it. The market will normally get tired of it a lot less frequently than you. Case in point, a lot of people have a conjecture-based philosophy of doing promotions or sales or mailings once or twice a year. And when I ask them, why do you do it? They'll say, well, I've been doing it that way. And I'll say, but why? And I'll say, well, I don't know. And I'll say, well, when you do it once a year, does that work better than if you did it 12 times a year? And they'll say, I don't know. And I'll say, do you just do it once a year because that's all your customers will respond? And they'll say, I don't know. I'll say, well, doesn't it make sense you should do it as often as it will stimulate new and old customers to buy from you and makes a profit? And they look at me and I'll say, I mean, doesn't make sense, does it? I mean, there's a classic story, and that is that if you do a mailing to a list, say you have a great mailing you do to an outside list or to your own customer list, and it pulls great. I mean, great, Marty.
Okay.
You can literally take the exact same mailing, turn right around the very next day, mail it exactly as it was to the same list again, and it will produce a low of 40% and a high of 80% again, the same results. Because at the time it was received, a very high portion of people didn't open it. A very high portion of the recipients opened it, thought about it, put it aside, and didn't act on it. A portion of it thought about it, didn't put it aside, decided I'm going to take advantage and didn't act on it. A portion of it didn't even get around to opening it, but have it in their pocket. And by just sending it again, people who didn't respond the first time are nurturously pushed to a higher level of action.
Wow. That's pretty profound.
Well, but the problem with a lot of business operators is they tire of things long before we do. I had a very funny discussion one time with a car dealer because they're probably the stereotypical practitioners of this attitude of stopping when things are still working. I said, do you understand most people don't love buying cars? And I said, an ad that works in the classified section this week probably will work next week and the week after and the week after, and you shouldn't just change it because you're tired of it, because the people reading this week are not the people reading next week. People reading this week are probably people who are about ready to buy a car. There'll be a little overlap, but most of them will be people who are new. They want to buy a car and get it over with. So the same promise, the same results, the same headline, the same proposition that worked to the group who wanted to buy a car last month will probably work to a group this month. You may be sick of seeing it because you live with it, but there's a new band of buyers every month coming in. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense. We'll catch dangerous myth number 9 from Jay Abraham on the Wizard's Edge on side 2.
Please allow this side to play approximately 15 seconds to queue up side 2.
All right, let's talk about the dangerous myth number 9. All of these have been extremely illuminating. What's number 9?
Number 9, Marty, is when preparing ads or radio or television commercials, people think they're supposed to appeal to everyone in the masses. That's impossible. Ads, mailing pieces, commercials all need a headline to call out those who are most qualified to be a prospect. You have to remember, they're listened to or heard or read by one person at a time. Most people, they try to dilute and homogenize or pasteurize the ads so much, and they try to write them so they're reading to the masses. They're only read by one individual at a time. When you see an ad in the paper, even if a million people read that paper and read that ad, it's being read by one person at a time, so it should be written to one person at a time. When you hear a radio commercial, it's being listened to by you, as far as you're concerned, all alone in your car or in your home, isn't it?
Rarely do I listen in a group of 100.
Think about that.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much it.
Okay.
Those are the 9 basic myths that I think most every business is susceptible to, and if you can acknowledge them, if you can change them, if you can alter your strategic approach to your business, I think you're in store for an incredible advantage. That's all.
Okay, I would like to follow you around for maybe about 4 weeks at a time and take a tape recorder and get you to dump out from time to time case studies. I never have had enough case studies. Can you share some with us?
Well, I'll give you a few right now. These are some interesting older ones, but then I'll give you some new ones on some subsequent calls. But a couple that are pretty interesting. We took Entrepreneur Magazine. We grew it by a real interesting philosophy of redeploying their assets. Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 70s was really not a magazine. It was an association called International Entrepreneurs Association. And as such, you would join for a year as a member, and as one of your member benefits, you'd get a newsletter that was formatted like a magazine. It looked like a magazine, but it was a newsletter.
Okay.
And in each issue, there was one or two 10 or 15-page primary feature articles that chronicled and identified an emerging small business area of profound opportunity. And let's take salad bars or yogurt shops or gourmet coffee shops or whatever.
Okay.
It would highlight and identify this emerging area. It then would provide an overview of the key critical factors relevant. In other words, the risk potential, the income potential, the investment required, and then it would give you really interesting insights into what to do to operate in that field, to get started. If you wanted to go through a franchise or it would tell you who the good ones were. If you wanted to do it yourself, it would give you recommendations. It was a really neat article. And at the end of that article, we would tell you people to call and organizations and everything. Then when the issue of the newsletter was no longer current, we would just take the article and put it in our archive. We didn't do anything with it. Then we started redeploying their assets. When I got there, it became evident we had all these archives of dozens and dozens and really hundreds of really great startup reports that were pretty fascinating and almost timeless stuff, except for certain ones that had already become hot or fizzled. We had to purge those. But we were able to take the 15-page startup report from our archive. We were able then to add to each report approximately 15 pages of what I'll call boilerplate. In other words, generic information anybody in business needed to know to be able to get started. How to use an attorney, how to negotiate a lease, how to get PR, how to get permits, how to hire people, critical legal and psychological issues, the mindset, strategic things. And we created startup manuals we sold for from between $29 to $45. And in 1 year we sold something like, I think, 200,000 of those reports. So our back end was created by redeploying the assets we'd already paid to create. The newsletter really wasn't doing that well, but it bore the cost of creating the editorial and these basic articles. By taking those articles, we were able to resell them as reports, and we made all our money on the report selling side.
Hmm. A lot of ways to apply that to our own lives.
It really was.
I always wanted to dig deeper, but how about another case study?
Sure. I had an experience that was partially me, partially someone else, but the combined integration was pretty neat. I was involved with the people who published the Saturday Evening Post and Holiday Magazine, and they were really shrewd people. The Saturday Evening Post dated back to, I think, the 1900s, and originally was owned by the original Curtis Publishing Company in Philadelphia. Curtis Publishing changed hands two or three times, and the last owner of it milked it to death, and it was in bankruptcy. These people bought it in bankruptcy for very little, if any, money down. They took over the fulfillment liability for Saturday Evening Post and a couple of other publications. The Saturday Evening Post had 1 million people who were owed, let's say, on average, 8 issues of the magazine. That was 8 million issues of a magazine that cost, let's say, 50 cents an issue to put out. So someone had to come up with $4 million to fulfill the liability, just to fulfill the debt that was owed to the subscribers. Then you had to have the editorial people and the salaries, et cetera, to be able to pay them all. And that was a lot. These people bought the magazine for virtually nothing.